David Prude and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up next is a special encore presentation of KBOO News in Depth. Then at 5:30, it's Coast Range Radio. Love listening to KBOO? Then show your support today. It's the last day to help KBOO meet our year-end fundraising goal, and we can only get there with your support. Just go to kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The KBOO Evening News is off this evening, and instead we present to you a look back at some of our favorite News in Depth pieces. Tonight we will be reflecting on the disparate ways that the coronavirus pandemic has impacted our communities. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence is a nonprofit group devoted to promoting equity and social change in order to end violence in all communities. The coalition organizes a multitude of local member organizations that do direct action work with those impacted by domestic and sexual violence. Supporting survivors of domestic and sexual violence has an added challenge thanks to the socially distanced world of coronavirus. Indeed, several cities in Oregon have seen spikes in their number of domestic violence or DV-related calls. I spoke with Renee Kim, the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, to learn more about how the coalition's work has changed during the pandemic, the opportunities for growth exposed by coronavirus, and radical self-care. So, you work as the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Can you tell me a little bit about what your work looked like outside of the pandemic context?
Yes. So, the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence is an organization that provides technical assistance and support to all of our statewide domestic violence and sexual assault programs. We conduct a ton of training. We have an annual conference, and we also do specific roundtables and webinars for our member programs and community partners. We also convene numerous caucuses and work groups, and we also work with policymakers doing legislative work and support for survivors' needs around the state.
And so how is that work, either, you know, specifically what you do or with the organizations that you work with, how has that work changed due to COVID-19?
It has changed dramatically because our work is so much in person and with community. And so the first thing that has really changed is we're working remotely, and we are doing a ton of phone calls as well as Zoom and different platforms to reach out to programs. I think that the biggest challenges for domestic violence programs and domestic violence survivors during COVID has been the isolation piece. When you are a survivor of domestic violence, oftentimes you are isolated anyway, away from family and friends and community networks. So sheltering in place and COVID has just compounded that. And I think that the messaging and communities, domestic violence, sexual assault agencies, is really important that they are still open. All of the programs that we support are still open across the state. And there have been a lot of different federal funds that have come down the pipeline to help programs during COVID with cell phones, laptops for advocates that are working with survivors. And some of the more rural programs around the state have continued some in-person services, but it's really changed. It's not walk-in. You have to make appointments, and then the social distancing guidelines as well.
So, you know, looking at the way that you would work to combat domestic violence pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, do you see, like, major differences there?
Yeah, I think that as far as combating domestic violence pre and within the COVID realm now, really hasn't changed, because all of the programs are still continuing to operate their 24-hour hotlines. There are programs, like I said, all over the state that continue to do support groups as well. Even though they may have been canceled in person, they are still able to do this online and meet with folks through different ways. And I think that the messaging around DV is still that, you know, we are here for you and we are here to advocate for you and to keep you safe.
Yeah, I know for a lot of different advocacy groups, pandemic restrictions have exposed holes in the way that we treat certain issues. And, you know, as such, because like you said, a lot of it is grounded in person. You go to this place and you get help in this way. And not being able to do that has kind of exposed the holes and how that doesn't work for everybody, and also offered, you know, an opportunity for growth and for new thinking. Do you see that the pandemic has offered new opportunities in your work?
I definitely have seen that. And one of the things that you mentioned, it just struck me. I was doing notes for this, but, you know, I don't really pay attention to my notes. I just start talking off the top of my head. So one of the things I was thinking about when you were asking this question is that it has brought to light many different things in the fight for social justice, especially around domestic violence, sexual assault work, and really understanding that, you know, many communities, especially marginalized communities, communities of color, queer and trans communities, non-English speaking communities, don't access domestic violence and sexual assault services the way that mainstream dominant culture white people access it. So it is very different. And I think that's really important to think about and reflect on, and think about how we may want to change things. So I lead several work groups for the coalition. One is the Communities of Color Task Force. The other is the People of Color Caucus. And I feel like the other light that has really been shed is that, you know, all of the advocates, so we support advocates who are supporting survivors. So many of the advocates that work with survivors are now, they're at home as well. So they're teaching their kids, they've got their pets and partners, and everything else is happening. And so they are really having to shift how they deliver services and how they do their work. And a lot of folks that enter this work also have some kind of trauma history. Not everybody does, but a lot of people do. And so when you think about everything that's going on in this world right now, It's bringing forth a lot of layers of what I call collective trauma. And so I've been reflecting a lot about how are the advocates doing? What kind of support do they need? How can we support them? We just recently at our office, we had a webinar on radical self-care. And I think that this is something that we definitely need to incorporate and teach ourselves and our advocates as well, so that it moves out into the community. I think that's really an important piece. I think people forget that people that do this work, they too also feel a lot of trauma when they're doing this work. And so having a trauma-informed lens and a practice of care is really important.
Can you tell me a little bit about what radical self-care looks like?
Yeah. Radical self-care to me looks like, it does not look like going to a spa or having food that's really small that you can't pronounce. It, to me, it's more about really taking time to reflect and step back from the work that you know is starting to bring you down. If you feel like you can't catch your breath, or you feel like you aren't really listening or fully present for people that are talking to you, or maybe you're feeling more agitated, that's the time when you do that radical self-care, when you step back and you decide, you know what, I'm going to have a big plate of pasta tonight. I'm going to watch a movie where I don't have to think, or I'm just going to go take a nap, you know, just things that kind of recharge you and rejuvenate you so that you can offer that same spirit of care to the people that you're working with.
Thank you for that. What do you find is most commonly misunderstood about domestic violence or DV and how, you know, we work to prevent it?
That is such a good question, and there's so many ways to answer that. I think some of the most commonly misunderstood things about domestic violence is that it is, you know, using air quotes, it's those people who are in those kinds of relationships. A lot of people think that people don't want to leave those relationships, or that they actually get like a rush from it, or it's exciting, or that these folks aren't smart, or they don't care about their kids, or they're drug addicts, or whatever. You know, the list goes on and on. And these things, I believe, are furthest from the truth, because domestic violence impacts everyone. Every one of us knows somebody who has been impacted or affected by domestic violence, and it crosses all race, ethnicity, income, and I believe strongly that prevention comes through education, and the coalition, we definitely support the programs across the state to provide prevention in the schools and in their communities.
So to that end, what would you say is most important for people to learn about DV and the struggle against it?
I would say that the most important thing to learn is that it truly can happen to any one of us. And again, I'll reiterate that all of us know someone, even if we think we don't know anyone, that has been touched by domestic violence in their life. I think that the other really tough struggle is that domestic violence sexual assault programs for forever have really struggled to have stable funding, and they almost rely solely on government funding. So donations and foundation grants mean so much to agencies across the state. So that's really important.
Renee, do you have any closing thoughts? Anything we didn't cover before we wrap up?
I have a closing thought. I really hope that with everything that's happening in the world right now, with the protests and with COVID and everything that's happening, that we are able to not forget that people really matter, and that survivors of domestic violence are really oftentimes very afraid and in some ways even ashamed to come forward or to talk to someone. And it's not their fault. I think our culture and our society lays a lot of victim blaming on people. And I really hope that that the things that are happening now is really, it's going to shift how we think and how we respect and care for people in this world. So those are my thoughts for today.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment. If our listeners are interested in getting involved in supporting the Coalition Against Domestic Violence or learning more about it, what's the best way for them to do that?
One of the best ways is to contact your local domestic violence sexual assault agency in your area, in your town. And there's a list on our website. If you go to ocadsv.org and you click on there, and you can find a map of all the programs throughout the state. And each program has a volunteer coordinator and program that you can talk with and learn how to get involved with your local DV agency.
Very cool. Well, Renee, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Althea. I appreciate it.
That was Renee Kim, the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. More information about the coalition and a directory of resources in your area available online at ocadsv.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to a KBOO News In Depth special, focusing on the impact of coronavirus on our community.
We are joined on the line now by Kai Hushka, who is with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We have heard recently that in the midst of this pandemic, one of the responses of the Trump administration is to cut regulations that the Environmental Protection Agency would normally be enforcing. Could you talk about what's being cut and what are the impacts of that?
Yeah, the decision which came out was basically about pulling back the Environmental Protection Agency, that's the federal part of the government, which is supposed to be overseeing activities that have environmental impacts, which include things like monitoring activities that have a high likelihood of environmental damage. So whether it's the fossil fuel industry or the industrial agricultural industry, but the federal government has had people and staff and resources pointed towards making sure that corporate interests are basically following the rules. And the decision was to basically freeze that, so to leave corporations really to monitor themselves. So there's been a lot of talk and chatter out there amongst environmental groups about the impact of really letting the foxes to guard the hen house kind of situation here, and really the ramifications to the environment and public health because of that. So these environmental agencies that we've relied on to protect us, and though they may have staved off some increased damage, really are just about monitoring our own demise. And so if anything that we should be really looking into at this time with the decision to basically freeze lots of elements of the EPA is to say, are these agencies really doing what we thought they were doing in the first place or should have been doing? And if not, what can we do differently in how we actually establish environmental protections? And if we really start to think about that, we have to do pretty much a radical overhaul, because the system we have today is really not about environmental protections, about monitoring how fast and to what degree we can actually destroy the environment under the guise that somehow we're protecting it.
Mm. And of course, these are considered externalities by our economic system, in that those producing the pollution don't then have to pay for the costs of the public health problems and the degradation of our environment, because those are not considered costs of doing business. One of the things that Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is pushing for is the rights of nature doctrine. What is that? What does it look like? And how would that be implemented? How would it be different than what the EPA does?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. That really goes to the heart of that deep overhaul. And part of that deep overhaul is really how systemically we look at ourselves as human populations, as economic systems, to our direct connection to the ecology that we're a part of. Rights of Nature is saying that if we don't actually honor those systems that sustain us in a manner that allows those systems to sustain themselves, we can see the writing on the wall. And that writing on the wall today, of course, is climate change, you know, global ecosystem collapse, the elements of desertification, ocean acidification, you know, viruses, pandemics, all of that stuff is really traceable to our own activities. Rights of Nature is saying that if we don't actually legally protect nature for nature's sake, we can see, and we are seeing what happens because of it. So instead of authorizing, as our current environmental laws do, the rate or the degree of environmental destruction, the consideration would be at the very front end on what we do as far as human activity is this going to affect nature's ability to exist, persist, naturally evolve, all the things that nature needs to do for our own benefit as well as nature's. And if not, well, those kinds of activities can't either start, or if they do happen, they would be in violation of nature's rights. So it's not a new concept in the sense of the world is concerned. It is very new in the sense of our own country having to kind of move into that legal reality. Other places have begun to do that and really put nature first and understand that our economic systems, our human communities need to be part of that, not destroy and dominate nature, but actually honor and protect it, and that we have to work within those natural boundaries and not exceed them.
What can states do in order to preserve or promote the rights of nature doctrine? I understand that in Pennsylvania recently, it was invoked in order to revoke a drilling permit. And here in Oregon, we've got the Jordan Cove fracking pipeline terminal that was recently approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission after having been disapproved at the state level. What can states do in response in order to actually invoke this rights of nature and prevent these types of fossil fuel infrastructure projects from moving forward in our states?
It's going to take people really standing up, organizing, and coming together for what they believe in and the values they believe in. And if you love and want to protect your place, you're going to have to move in a very different manner than the system currently says is quote-unquote allowable. So places like Grant Township, even places like Lincoln County and Oregon have stood up for what they believed in, which is to say we have a right to clean air and clean water, natural ecosystems, rivers, watersheds have a right to exist and be unpolluted. And what they've done is asserted that through lawmaking. So they have passed local laws that really do two things. One, put forward the new notion of what the legal structure needs to look like in protecting nature's rights, but simultaneously challenging higher levels of law. So challenging state law that says, well, you can't protect yourselves at a better level than we say is allowable, even though what states are often doing is not really protecting the environment. They're allowing that corporate activity to move forward that destroys that environment that people in counties or communities are trying to protect. So there's a direct challenge, a resistance to really unjust law. So it's not so different than civil rights movements when they've had to challenge unjust law. People are doing it now from an environmental perspective. And through that, you begin to see momentum building, as in Grant Township, whether it's through legal breakthroughs or at least legal validation, but more importantly, the recognition that we have an upside-down system that has disempowered communities from protecting themselves, and Rights of Nature has become this vehicle of which communities are standing up for themselves, pushing back against unjust state and federal law as a means to begin to try to change that structure. And you're starting to see some movement that eventually could mean changing constitutional structures at the state or federal level.
just for our listeners, if you could detail a little more about what exactly happened in Grant Township and why it's so significant.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. It's a sad one, a hopeful one, an ever-changing one in the sense of their saga. You know, it's 5 years in the making. You have a tiny little, 600-700 person community who was basically targeted for toxic industrial waste. So waste product coming in from the hydraulic fracturing industry, which is, the process for a pretty pervasive process now to pull up natural gas. There's a byproduct that's toxic, and they have to find places to get rid of it. So they basically target places where there are dried up drill wells and then inject this toxic waste into the ground with really no concept of the impact it's going to have environmentally and on public health. And this community said, no, we don't want it. All the while, the state was saying it's fine. And so they passed a law saying we don't want this under our ability to protect our rights and to make these kind of decisions and protect the ecosystems as part of our own communities, not just the humans, but the non-human species. And as happens in these kind of cases, you had the fossil fuel industry suing them to say, no, our ability to basically poison your community is greater than your ability to protect it. And then, interestingly enough, the state regulatory agency stepped in and also sued the community, saying, hey, you can't do this. We think it's fine, and you're going to get the toxic waste whether you want it or not. And the most recent thing that you mentioned was the state basically backing down, saying, well, we're going to revoke the permits now because there looks to be some possibility that the communities actually can have a higher standard. And we don't know what's going to happen here, but we're going to pull these permits and stop the fossil fuel company from dumping the toxic waste, and rightfully so, capitulate to the community who's saying we want a higher standard of protection, and you, the state, must honor that. It's a pretty shocking change of course, and whether it holds or not is yet to be seen. But this idea that communities need more recognized power to protect themselves is not a new thing, and it really ranges across a broad spectrum of issues. Whether it's gentrification of neighborhoods, whether it's more classic environmental issues, whether it's labor issues, we're all been handcuffed at the community level instead of actually being freed and liberated from making the real critical decisions. And it's really come from corporate powers, but corporate powers manipulating state and federal government to come crashing down on us. So the resistance, the effort to make laws they did in Grant Township to say, no, we don't want this, and really stand up to what they believe in, and run, go the distance, is really a pretty amazing story, and hopefully an inspirational one for communities everywhere to do the same, because we all have our issues and we're all facing a very similar structure that is coming, decisions coming from the top down, or as we started out our conversation here, the so-called agencies that are protecting us making decisions that, well, we're no longer going to, send out people to monitor the damage that's being caused, and so you're kind of on your own. I think is actually a great opportunity for communities, whether it's smaller ones or even larger cities, to really, really take the reins and say, no, we clearly need more power to protect ourselves, to evolve ourselves. And there's been a massive failure systemically induced, really, at the state and federal level. And it's time we have a different paradigm here.
I want to thank you for joining us today. Again, I've been speaking with Kai Huske, who is with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Their website is celdf.org. I know they've got some webinars, some organizing going on. So that website, again, is celdf.org. Thank you, Kai, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thanks for giving me the time. Really appreciate it.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
This has been a KBOO News In-Depth special on coronavirus's impact this year. Thanks to Jenka Soderberg, who contributed to this report, and thank you to everyone who has helped with our volunteer-produced newscast this year. For KBOO News In-Depth, I'm Althea Billings. KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a part of this year's Give Guide by Willamette Week, What's GiveGuide? GiveGuide is the fast and easy way to donate to any of the 174 participating nonprofits. Each nonprofit was chosen by GiveGuide because of the good they do for our local communities, so show your support today. Every dollar you donate to KBOO on GiveGuide goes directly to the radio station. Just go to kboo.fm/give. It's the last day to give, so donate today. That link again is kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Listening to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. Interested in connecting to the show? Email us at andrew@coastrange.org. To hear past episodes of Coast Range Radio, you can visit coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. You can also download and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Kai Hushka of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund about the community rights movement and the exciting examples of communities standing up to corporate power to protect their local environment and community health. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio. My name is Andrew, and today we are speaking with Kai Hushka. Kai is the Northwest and Hawaii community organizer for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Kai is also a lecturer for Democracy School and a board member of the Oregon Community Rights Network. Hey, Kai, thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
At the Coast Range Association, we've worked with different community rights groups throughout Oregon, Community Rights Lane County, Lincoln County Community Rights, other groups, Oregon Community Rights Network. I'm interested to learn how you work to support those groups and how you got involved in community organizing and your work with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
Yeah, I mean, it started for me in the community where I currently live. So I live in actually in Spokane, Washington. Started connecting with people here back in 2008, I think it was. There was a kind of a new coalition forming in the community to really talk, I guess, about community. And it was people working in sort of traditional issue arenas. There was a sort of common theme of which people had been experiencing was that they had a lot of difficulty really achieving what it is that they thought would be just and equitable, that they always seemed to be running into a wall, so to speak. And so the organization I work for now, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, was called in to sort of help formulate some discussions about, you know, why is that? Why do you keep running into what feels like barriers to doing the good work? And it was through those basic community discussions that this group had formed, which I became a part of, that eventually led to some local initiative efforts to, in a lot of ways, redefine how community operates, who decides, what it looks like, how do we build in greater equity, sustainability, justice, you know, vitality, really, whether you're talking about nature itself or neighborhoods or the workplace. And so I guess you could say I cut my teeth in both the organizing world and the community rights world by participating in that local effort, and that eventually led me to starting to move out in other places in the Northwest and Washington State, eventually down into Oregon, and connecting with the people, as you mentioned, in Lane County and Lincoln County and other places that were, even though maybe dealing with issues that were specific to their community, they too are running into that structure, that barrier that everyone could feel but couldn't really name. And so our work's in a large degree trying to expose what that system is, what that structure is, and why ultimately it's so critical to to really dig deep to deal with that, because otherwise we're kind of locked in or boxed in the sense of what we are allowed to or what's permissible to do within our communities, which often people understand is falls very, very short of what's really needed and necessary when it comes to our public health, whether it comes to our economic health, whether it comes to our environmental health. And so the community rights work, as you'd mentioned the name a couple times, to the different groups and the state network, really has been about not only talking about that structure, explaining it, educating it, people about it, but getting people to really invest real time to saying, well, we can't have it this way and we can do it differently. So let's start working towards that.
You mentioned some of these restrictions. What do you mean by, so what is, you know, stopping folks who are, you know, passionate about these issues that you mentioned, all these different issues, what's stopping them from making a difference or really making a change?
Yeah, there's a number of ways you could sort of answer that question. There are clearly cultural barriers. There's political barriers. I think there's individual psychological barriers to our own belief that we could have a different and better system. A lot of our work, though, starts with how law works, how government works, who has so-called authority. A great example, I'm sure, with a lot of your work there and a lot of your discussions in communities along the coast and elsewhere when you're talking about forests and forest health, the topic of state preemption. So this idea that the state has the authority to dictate what forest activities are going to look like, which without much digging into it, you see is really about doing the bidding of corporate interests who have a different view of what forests are compared to the people who live there, for instance. So state preemption is a real barrier when you live in a community that says, you know what, the way that this corporatization of forests is going, that corporations can basically own the natural world, or that they're using these practices that incorporate highly toxic chemicals, or the means of which, because of the way that timber has become so industrialized and commodified, it's really having this huge and dire and devastating impact to salmon populations. And, you know, why can't we do anything really substantial about it? Well, you run into state preemption because it says you can't, or you don't have the authority where you live to make those critical decisions. We do at the state. You have other elements like corporate constitutional rights, which seems maybe ethereal and academic and for lawyers to debate, but it's a real problem amongst all kinds of issue arenas when corporations can wield greater legal rights than people in the natural environment. And there are other barriers around how we view nature itself. So nature under law today is property. Nature's a thing. It doesn't have rights like people. Therefore, it can be owned and controlled and ultimately violated in ways that I think people would be quite distraught at if we treated people in the same way that we treat the environment, even though in a lot of ways we still kind of see people as property. So these real barriers, these legal doctrines, these ways that government functions, that often, even if they're understood, they're never really questioned. They're looked at as, well, it is what it is, so we'll work with what we have. And so a lot of activism goes into the idea that, well, we can't change it, so I guess we'll do our best with the bad set of rules that we've been handed. And so the work around community rights has been saying, well, no, if this is how the system operates, and this is really ultimately why we're at where we're at, why don't we put real energy into actually changing that? Because ultimately people wrote rules, wrote laws. Why can't we write different rules and different laws that actually validate our value system, for instance? And if someone doesn't start doing that, well, then shame on us for expecting something new to emerge if we're not actually calling into question the system we have, let alone calling for the system that we want.
Interesting. Yeah, that really gets to the heart of it and brings up some questions for me. One, you know, when we talk about things like community forestry or thinking about Lincoln County's ban on aerial spray, I do hear some arguments that kind of speak to this, do communities have the expertise or resources to make these decisions? How do you counter a critique of that level, where communities maybe, you know, you give the community more, you build up these community rights, but are they necessarily going to be practicing, you know, better forestry or improving people's health or any of these kind of structural issues that we're still trying to address? How does the community rights issues address that?
Yeah, it's a great question, I think, that also can be approached a lot of different ways. Main thing, for one, just because you're advocating for the idea of community self-determination doesn't necessarily mean that it's community self-determination in isolation. So I think people immediately go to, well, this sort of self-interested mindset, which is, of course, a dominant cultural reality today that gets reinforced by the economic system of consumerism and so on. So the idea that immediately when you say a community has some authority to make these kinds of decisions around, you know, forest practices or forest health, that somehow they're going to do it in a selfish manner, I think undermines really what communal thinking and community decision making could really be. And then historically in Oregon itself, you know, if you dig into some of the early realities around timber practices before the advent of the large corporate behemoths that dictate, you know, the commodification of timber today, it was really the communities that were doing far more conservation and protection of the forest than the state or others outside of their community. There's some great history even in places like Josephine County, where it speaks to what people in their own communities used to do to protect, you know, their land base in a higher way than the state was doing. So I think part of it is we've kind of lost faith in ourselves or trust that we're going to make the right decisions. When if you really go upstream, a lot of this has come because a wealthy few have dictated the system and then made us indentured to that. I mean, again, if you speak to timber, I mean, think about how mechanicalized it's become and how commodified it's become and how you're the only way to participate is to be in that corporate mindset of how timber works. And in doing so, you've sort of washed out the capability of people to really think more holistically about what does a healthy forest look like? How does economics work for that? How do we become stewards of that where we potentially gain economic benefit, but we don't destroy full ecosystems in the process? So part of it is just kind of reattaching ourselves to place and one another. Another way to answer that is, as the work has been articulated over the years in the sense of community rights, which means as things have moved from purely the local level to consideration of what it would look like to change, again, those rules at the state level. So as it works today, corporate interests have been very good at going into the state legislatures like Salem or Olympia or, you know, Sacramento or wherever it is that they're wanting to operate, and making sure they write the rules that benefit that particular industry. And then they make sure that those legislators who they work with put that in place. And then everything beneath that has to adhere to that those set of rules. And unfortunately, a lot of those rules that have been set are on a course of destruction, or they're actually unsustainable. So they're legalizing unsustainability. And I think you can make that case pretty easily and quickly when it comes to forestry in Oregon, that they've legalized unsustainable forestry. So if you take that sort of viewpoint, why couldn't we legalize sustainable forestry? What's so outrageous to think that you could rewrite the rules to be about sustainability, which is about the community's health, the public health, the economic health, the social health, the environmental health? And knowing how our system works today and where power sits, where the work has evolved to is to said, well, until we decentralize power to where communities have the capability to push back up against the realities of the overreach of things like state preemption on the behest of corporate interests, we're going to lose. And we are losing. We have been losing. For decades, we've been losing. So when someone looks at one slice of forestry like aerial spray of pesticides and comes to their own conclusion often the on-the-ground activists in communities know far more about the topic than industry or state legislators themselves. So I would also challenge the idea that we don't know. You could probably walk around Lincoln County or Lane County, other places, and every fifth person you ask is probably going to be pretty knowledgeable about forestry practices, the impacts of it. So I think it's also undercutting our ability to have knowledge on stuff and to make critical decisions, or at the very least, to know when something is harming us and to say it has to stop. That until you have the ability to counter the power of that overreach of centralized decision-making with the capability of dictating stuff from underneath to say, we have a different standard, you're going to get what you get. So the way that the work in the sense of local self-government, local self-determination, local democracy, however you want to phrase it, is to say local communities, whether it's a city or county, need the capability to raise the standards. So if the state has set a certain standard, that the standard should be seen as a floor. And if that standard is not enough because the state hasn't caught up to the realities of information, or they made a mistake in the beginning, or corporate pressure said, don't go there, this gives the ability of communities to put pressure to say, well, no, we're going to go there. Maybe somebody else goes there. And next thing you know, the rules maybe get changed eventually at that higher level in a method that aren't capable today because of the amount of control that corporate interests have had on things like timber, which is, I mean, everyone knows it. There was a great, and I'm sure you guys tracked it, there was a great journalistic piece by the Oregonian this past spring that spelled it out, you know, and great progressive green Oregon, you know, who runs timber? Well, it's the corporate boys. And so we have no good means to counter that. And to believe that we're gonna, you know, out-lobby the pros at lobbying, I think is also sort of a foolish venture. So if we're going to lobby for something, why not lobby for power and decision-making power where it resides or what should reside, which is down at the community level? Because one, that's our home. We love where we live. We want to protect it. Plus, if we elect representatives, it gives them capability that they don't have today. Because often local officials, even if they're good-hearted and side with you, they'll throw up their hands saying, well, there's nothing I can do about it. You know, corporate rights supersede our local rights, or state preemption's coming in, or other legal doctrines that exist out there override our ability to do basically the right thing. So again, I think there's a lot of ways to kind of wrestle with your original question about when people say, well, won't people, in a way, and I'm paraphrasing you now, but won't they do bad things with it, for instance? You know, part of it is going to be sort of remembering that we have capabilities, and it's not always the case that the so-called experts really are the experts about what our community needs or wants or deserves.
So I'd like to go into some on the ground examples. And you brought up a question. First off, maybe we'll start with this. When you're dealing with state preemption, is it enough to go to say the Oregon level, the state level, or is it all the way the federal, the national level? Is that really where this movement and the work of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is going through these different on the ground, actions or on the ground community organizing efforts? Is it the state level where it really can make a change, or is it higher up?
Yes and yes and yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's a multi-part answer to that.
Yeah.
Yes, making changes at the state level would drastically change the relationship between the communities, the state, and ultimately corporate power. So you can definitely make some pretty dramatic shifts in creating very large openings for not just advocacy purposes or just to be heard purposes, but actually policymaking purposes for people who are looking at, you know, a right to shelter, right to housing, or people looking at the health of forests and the forest rights, or looking at elements of how development operates, or looking at the reality of how we produce food. You know, changing things at the state level, let's say through ratifying or adopting an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that secures local democracy would have pretty drastic changes. It wouldn't be immediate, but it would allow localities the ability to exercise a power that they don't have today, or that they're told that they don't have, or that they get punished if they act out in that particular way. At the same time, there are, of course, in our way of system government works, you have the community level, the state level, and the federal level. And there are elements, of, as you brought up, rightfully so, of sort of federal power that have to be contended with. So it's not purely looking at the law. It's not purely about policy and politics. Maybe even more importantly, it's about building a mind shift, a movement of sorts, a transformation to say, you know, the way our government's ordered, the way that power has been able to localize in the hands of the few, and with that, economically just speaking, the ability to control wealth, which when you control wealth, it's not just the money, but it's also usually the land base. Of course, you have the ability then to write the rules that then benefit you. And in very, very rare cases, can't even think of one, do you have an altruistic mind that you're there to really benefit or be part of the whole? You're usually there to enrich yourselves. Saw a crazy statistic about if, you know, that the richest 100 people in the world have the ability to wipe out economic poverty four times over. I mean, that's how much wealth they're holding.
Yeah.
And we're a planet of billions. So part of it is to say, well, we've got to move to that federal level eventually from the state, so that we change those relationships as well. And that's where echoing back or looking at how other people's movements have done their work is important, to see what have they done, what did they do well, what didn't they do well, how deep did they go, did they go deep enough, and ask us ourselves really those critical questions, and be willing to, you know, to rock the boat. Justifiably so in my mind, because if our system has basically been built to protect property and commercial pursuits over that of the rights of people in the environment and our communities, that's a huge flaw in what we've been taught. Sort of the great myth of democracy and, you know, the Constitution itself. I mean, you got to reconcile with all that, and hopefully once you do and can see it for what it is, you start to mobilize and say, we can do it better. We can do it differently. But we have to have that mindset that it's going to be a bit of a long haul game. But again, people of a certain time wrote the rules. And if those rules aren't working to match the needs of today, then we're fully capable of rewriting rules that match what we know, whether it's about civil rights, whether it's about the natural world, whether it's about how capitalism has ultimately failed us. Whatever it is, we've got enough information out there. We don't have any lack of information. I think we have sometimes a lack of imagination and a lack of willpower and a belief that it can be done. That's really important when places like Lincoln County and others, you know, challenge the status quo on that basis, that we not only applaud that and learn from it, but that we replicate it in other places. And that's the way things build, and that's how you build the potential meter up from where it sits now, and real change can actually happen at that point.
That's great. And you brought up Lincoln County. I wanted to get into a couple of concrete examples. Where is the Lincoln County aerial spray ban? Where is that currently? Just maybe real quick. And then the community rights amendment that is being worked towards by the Oregon Community Rights Network. What's happening there?
Well, in Lincoln County, you had an example, as we've been talking about, people who saw a problem. They went to the system. They asked the system to address it, and the system said no. In fact, not only said no, but whatever was happening was perfectly fine because it's perfectly legal. And, you know, years and years, if not decades worth of activism, finally a group of people came together and said, well, no one's listening. It's time we actually organize ourselves and put a different question forward. So Lincoln County in 2017, you know, put forward a ballot measure recognizing people's rights to protect their public health, to protect ecosystems from a basis of rights, not to see the natural world just as a thing or a piece of property, but secure its rights so it has a way to speak for itself. And in the process said, we're going to ban aerial spray of pesticides, something that even the industry has known for decades is horribly poisonous and toxic and damaging. And in that process, I think they sent shockwaves through Oregon as to how dare they, the corporate industry, state officials, even some established environmental groups. But practically speaking, it put a two-year ban on aerial spraying. Of course, as expected, corporate interests came in and sued to overturn it. 2 years later, the lower court agreed with corporate interests that the locality of Lincoln County doesn't have authority over this. And in the meantime, that group of activists said, well, yes, we do. And they've appealed that decision. So that case sits in an appellate court. More so maybe than the legal case, what should be lauded again is that people stood up, you know, for their rights and to protect themselves in a system that was not only uninterested in protecting them, but systematically continue to allow the destruction of people in the natural world. And as a outbirth of Lincoln County standing up, it really opened up the door for this broader question about who decides and why don't communities have more authority to decide things like raising the ceiling on rent control or raising the minimum wage or allowing greater decision-making when it comes to development issues or how do you protect the environment, whether it's the water or your forest or so on. And this is where the local democracy or community rights amendment has come about. And so there's currently an effort underway to get local elected officials, issue groups, the general public to really build support under this to then hand it off to the legislature to say, hey, this is an important issue for Oregon, whether you're talking about Burns or Bend or Yahats or Portland or Medford. Every community has their issue, and if you start talking to people, whether it's elected officials or locals, there's a real frustration that they're not able to advocate for themselves in the way that they should. And this amendment saying, well, this would allow you to actually dig into these important issues and really address them in a deeper way that you're not allowed to today. And the ask is to get legislators to not pass the amendment, but just put it in front of the voters of Oregon. So constitutional amendments have to go to the vote of the people. So the ask is, hey, this is an important issue. Put it on the ballot. Let Oregonians wrestle with this question. Talk about, you know, local control, local democracy. What does it mean? What does it look like? What are the upsides? What are the potential downsides? But it's a debate that's been long overdue. And if anything, the amendment can crack open a very, very, very important discussion, not only for those communities, but how those communities link to other communities. And so the ask is, hey, legislatures, this question is too important to ignore anymore. Put it on the ballot, let the people make the decision. And if they decide that this is where they want to go, then we open up the possibility here or the real legal channel for communities like Lincoln County to say, hey, aerial spraying is no good. We're actually going to restrict it. And guess what, corporate interests, you're going to have to adhere to our local rules because we have a higher standard of protection. And that's how it should be. And unfortunately today, that is not how it is. And this is about changing those kind of things for the better.
So Kai, this information is awesome. I wish we had more time to talk. How do people learn more, get involved, learn some of the nuts and bolts of this?
Yeah, I think two websites. One would be the Oregon Community Rights Network website. So that's orcrn.org. And then also through CELDEF, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. So CELDF.org. Great information, great way to connect to other people, other groups, just general information. But it's a good place to start if you're just kind of getting up to speed on what's happening here to really say we can do it differently and people are working on that, not just challenging what is, but actually suggesting what it could be.
Kai, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, Andrew, thanks for the time and for letting me to have these discussions with you. It's been great.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you next time.
This is the last day to support KBOO in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for over 50 years. Your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join thousands of your friends and neighbors in giving back by supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. We're very close to meeting our goal that we need to meet by midnight tonight, December 31st. So go to kboo.fm/give today. And don't forget, we have a one-to-one match for all new members and current members increasing their donations up to $25,000 thanks to the support of an anonymous donor. It's the last day. So go to kboo.fm